Thank you very much for the invitation to speak. So indeed, I'll be talking about some old and some newer results in NV cycles. And at the end of my talk, I want to kind of throw out a computational challenge, which maybe you could say fits in the framework of affine Schubert calculus. So let's take G to be a semi-simple group over the complex numbers. So the main player in my talk today will be the affine Grassmannian for G. So I define this to be G of K mod G of O, where K is the field of the Laurent series, O is the subring Taylor series. And so the kind of motivation for what I'll be doing is comes from the geometric Satake correspondence. I should not write any lower. So the geometric Satake correspondence, which relates the geometry / topology of the affine Grassmannian to the representation theory, not of the group G we started with, but rather its Langlands dual group, G check. So this is just the group whose kind of whose root datum is dual to that of G. So for example, if G is PGLN, then G check is epsilon. Okay. So I write it this way because somehow usually we're interested in the representation theory of something like SLN, and then we study the affine Grassmannian for PGLN. Okay. So I'll start by explaining kind of essentially one manifestation of this geometric Satake correspondence. So before then, I'll need to say a few more words about the geometry of the affine Grassmannian. There will probably be some overlap with what I write now with what has appeared in some previous talks, for example, in Elizabeth's talk. So for mu in x, so x here will be the weight lattice of my group G check, or the co-weight lattice of my group G, so Hom C star into T, the maximal torus of G. But this is the same as the weight lattice of G check. I guess maybe I won't write anymore. Okay, well, better not write anymore. Okay, for mu in that weight lattice of G check, I get a point T to the mu inside the affine Grassmannian, because mu is a map of C star into T, in particular it's a map of C star into G, so that particular means it's an element, or I can expand it as a Laurent series. So I get T to the mu inside the affine Grassmannian. So for example, in the case when G is, say, P GLN, this mu will be mu1 up to mu n, well defined up to overall addition by 1, and the corresponding elements in affine Grassmannian will be represented by this matrix. So that's in that example. It kind of explains the notation T and mu as well. Now we're going to be concerned with orbits of these elements by two different groups. So the first group we're going to look at the orbits of is the group G of O. So that's the group that we quotiented on the right. So we look at the left action of left multiplication. We denote this orbit through T to the mu. Actually, we'll only do it for dominant lambdas. We'll call that Gr lambda. So here lambda will be the dominant weight of G check. And we have the following decomposition. These are the orbits where, in other words, you get each orbit once this way. So in each orbit, there's a unique T lambda for lambda dominant. And the second kind of orbits. Oh, before I get to the second kind of orbits, I like to draw some pictures of these orbits. So I'll explain a little bit more about what these pictures mean later. But the way I draw a picture of this orbit is I take lambda in the weight lattice. I look at the Weyl orbit through lambda. So I'm going to draw the SL3 case. Here's the Weyl orbit through lambda. It's a kind of longish one, a shortish one. minus 1. Yeah. So that's supposed to be the violator Mitzvah lambda, and this is supposed to be its convex hull. So that's my picture of this square lambda. Convex hull, the violator Mitzvah lambda. And the second kinds of orbits I'm going to look at are something that's called semi-infinite orbits. So I take the group n minus, just for normalization purposes, of k. So here, n minus is the unipotent radical of the opposite Borel in G. And so I look at this n minus orbit, k orbit through, say, t to the mu for weight mu, call it s mu, and then similarly, I get every orbit of this group once this way. So through each orbit, there's a unique to the mu. We're now muing it over the whole weight lattice. And these guys, I'll picture in the following way. So I take my mu, and I look at inside the weight lattice, and I look at everything you can get to by adding positive roots. And that's the picture of this S mu. That's the picture of S mu. That's a picture of Greer lambda. Okay. So now we're interested in intersections of these two orbits. So in particular, say, Greer lambda intersects F mu, and this is pure dimensional. Of dimension rho with lambda minus mu. So this intersection is not, it's a reducible variety. It has a bunch of irreducible components, but each irreducible component has the same dimension, namely this thing. That's what it means to be pure dimensional. And so now I'll state the following theorem of Mirkovich and Bellonin. So, which is part of this geometric Sasaki correspondence. So the theorem goes like this. There is an isomorphism between the intersection homology of Greer lambda bar. So intersection homology is some modification of homology for use on singular spaces, in particular singular algebraic varieties. It satisfies the Poincaré duality for singular projective varieties. So then that's what appears here, the kind of homology theory that we're going to use on our Greer lambda bar. So there's an isomorphism between this intersection homology of Greer lambda bar and V lambda. So V lambda here is the irreducible representation for G of highest weight lambda. Mm-hmm. So that's good because, I mean, that makes sense because this X, which is Hom of C star into the torus of G, is the same as the weight lattice of G check. So, and lambda is dominant, so there is a ERAP of G with highest weight lambda. That makes sense. Pre-check. Anyway. So there's an isomorphism, like this. And moreover, two things. So the first part of the moreover is that we can study this intersection homology in the following way. So let me say it like this. As a basis, actually, let me write it like this. This intersection homology is isomorphic to a direct sum over all mu's in the weight lattice, although not only finally many of them will contribute, of the top homology, so homology in this degree, which is the dimension, which is twice the complex dimension of this thing. So you can study this intersection homology in terms of these intersections. And moreover, continuing this moreover, this decomposition matches the weight space decomposition of V of lambda. So this EREP, it's a representation of G check. It has a weight space decomposition according to the weights of the torus. That's which is x. And this left-hand side also has a kind of weight space decomposition like this. And under this isomorphism, this decomposition matches the decomposition of this. So the conclusion of this is that the irreducible components of just these Gur lambda intersect S mu give a basis for this topology. So that's just general fact. They give a basis for this, and hence for the weight spaces of our representation V of lambda. So the basic problem is to try to study something about these components instead of study something about the resulting basis. So the components, these components are called MV cells. Okay, so that's good. So that's all of the kind of general theory that I'm going to need, and now we sort of get down to sort of more combinatorial descriptions of these MV cycles and the basis. So the way we get to, we sort of want a more explicit description of MV cycles rather than saying they're components of these intersections. So this is kind of the old results on MV cycles. So for, it goes like this. So for W in the Weyl group, I'm going to consider a twisted version of the N minus, so just W N minus W inverse, and correspondingly consider a twisted version of these orbits. Instead of orbits of N minus, take orbits of this N W of K. Take the NW of K orbits through T to mu. Distill these orbits cover that Fengersmannian for each W, the corresponding orbits cover that Fengersmannian. Here's the theorem, which is that every NV cycle Z inside the lambda intersect S mu. Maybe I should say at some point I may have got a little sloppy with putting bars. So let me put a bar now, from now on. But you could have put bars on some number of the previous Gur lambda intersect S mu. Maybe on all of them. If you want to be better to put bars over at Gur lambda. Okay, every MV cycle in there is of the form it's equal to the following thing. It's some big intersection over all elements in the Weyl group of these corresponding S mu W W bar, or some collection of weights mu W W N. For every MV cycle, there's some collection of weights such that MV cycle is realized as this closure of this big intersection. And this is kind of gets us more in the realm of combinatorics. So think of the nice combinatorial object. So we have, you could say the combinatorial object now is just this collection of weights, or a nicer way to picture it is as a polytope. So associated with Z, we consider the following polytope, namely the convex hull of exactly that set. Convex hull of this set that appears there. So So that kind of starts to explain what those pictures are. So let me just do a quick example of such a thing. So if we take lambda to be 1, 0, minus 1, mu to be 0, 0, 0, so our corresponding Gur lambda, let me draw it over here, our corresponding Gur lambda maybe looks like this. Here is the zero vertex. Our corresponding S, okay, let me do the S guy in a different color. S guy is going like this. Yeah. There's the S guy. So their intersection, then this intersection has two components. The fact that there's two components corresponds to the fact that the corresponding highest weight representation is the adjoint representation, has a two-dimensional zero weight space for the adjoint representation of SL3. Sorry, maybe if you hadn't worked out, here G is here G check is SL3 in this example. Probably in all my pictures and examples, G check will be SL3. And there's two MV cycles. One of them has a polytope is like this. And the other one, the polytope, is the other part. So those are two MV polytopes. This triangle and this one corresponds to these two components. Another way to define the MV polytope is to say that it's the moment map image of an MV cycle under a moment map for a torus action, real torus action. Not going to come up that much in the talk, but that's somehow the original way in which the MV polytopes are defined. I didn't really say that. These things are called MV polytopes. So it's possible to give a complete combinatorial characterization of which polytopes are MV polytopes, and hence which intersections, like which collections of this, give you MV cycles. But I won't describe that in this talk, but it's not that hard. So let me just continue. So there's a crystal structure. On the set of MV cycles. MV cycles. Due to Braverman and Gates-Gordy. And there's a corresponding crystal structure on the set of MV polytopes. Which I'll now describe. So that P, which is say the convex hull of some collection mu w, w and w, be an MV polytope. And let's say that it's an MV polytope for a component of Gur lambda intersect S mu bar. If it's the case, then the mu for the identity vertex, well, already this intersection involves S mu. So S mu is the same as S mu 1, because that would be taking the identity value group element, so it wouldn't change this N thing at all. So already you sort of know one piece of information, that this mu 1 has to be mu. And then it's also true that the mu for W 9 has to be lambda. Okay. So this MV polytope looks like this. And this is actually a picture of what the SL3 MV polytopes look like. Like this. So here we have lambda mu W naught U equals U1. Okay, so I'm trying to describe you the crystal structure. And let me just describe you the action of the raising operator, EI. So then EI tilde, so in particular the weight of the MV polytope, if you think of it inside this representation, V of lambda, the weight is mu, because it's a component of square lambda in this system. So the EI operator will produce an MV polytope, which is weight higher by alpha I. So let me say that EI of P has vertices mu prime W for W and W, where, so I already, so from the thing, you already know that the mu prime one vertex had better move up alpha I from where it was before. So this is mu one plus alpha I. And the second thing the second thing that's clear immediately is that this vertex is unchanged because I want it to be a component of Gur lambda intersect S mu plus alpha I. So this will be a polytope for component of Gur lambda mu plus alpha I. So this vertex will be unchanged. Actually, much more vertices will be unchanged. Exactly half the vertices will be unchanged. So mu prime W will equal mu W if SIW is smaller than W. So for the half the vertices that are lowered by left multiplication by SI, they'll be unchanged. So in this example, that means this one, and this one will be unchanged. This one will be moved here, and there's actually a unique such MV polytope looks like this. Some reason. This way. Like this. So that's what the crystals will do. I mean, I guess I should have said the following at the beginning. EI tilde of P is equal to zero if you cannot do this thing, which means that you can't do this thing when this vertex and this vertex coincide. So if mu SI is equal to mu 1, then it kills the P. And if not, it does this crystal operator. The crystal operator acts like this. Okay. So the result is about this crystal structure is this is a well-defined crystal structure, and it matches this geometrically defined crystal structure on the MV cycles due to Braverman and Gates score. So we want to go a little further than just crystal structure. We want to really understand the basis. In particular, we want to understand how the Chevalier generators of our Lie algebra act on this basis. So by this I mean we have V lambda is a G check representation. So I want to understand, and this V lambda is the same thing as this intersection homology of square lambda bar, and this is where the MV cycles are giving us a basis. And so this thing is G check representation, and hence, so I understand how this G check is really acting in some combinatorial way. So a nice place to start is to think of it as the Lie algebra, so it's a G little check representation, and G little check has Chevalier generators. EIs and FIs, so I ranges over the Dynkin diagram. So in the case of G equals SLN, this EI is just the matrix that has a 1 just above the diagonal one spot. Okay. So to get started with this problem, you sort of need to know a bit more about the geometric satake correspondence, because all I told you right now is the theorem that this, that these two are isomorphic, but I haven't said anything really about how the G-check is acting here. So I'm going to need one piece of information about how the G-check is acting. Actually, I told you already one piece of information about how G-check is acting here, which is that I told you that the weight decomposition here, according to this, how the which S mu, the MV cycle, is the component of Grillander intersect S mu, that decomposition matches the weight decomposition here. So I've already told you how the torus is acting here, but I still need to tell you a bit more information. Okay. So a bit more information is given in the following fashion. So let L be a very ample line bundle. On that Fenger's money. So when G is actually simple, so if G is simple, then there's a kind of unique minimal variable line bundle under Riemannian. So typically I'll be thinking about that case then. Unique minimal such guy. So it's provided by the basic representation of the affine algebra. The projectivization of the basic representation of the affine algebra. I mean the line bundle isn't, but the projective embedding that corresponds is that. So corresponding to this very ample line bundle, you get this embedding of the affine Grassmannian into projective space, infinite dimensional projective space. I mean the complication of all these dealing with affine Grassmannian is that it's something infinite dimensional. So necessarily this is also infinite dimensional. But nonetheless, the following theory all goes through, so we get from this projective embedding, or rather from the line bundle, we can consider its first turn class, which will be an element in H upper 2 of the affine Grassmannian. And we have an action of the cohomology of the affine Grassmannian on the intersection homology of Grillander bar. So this is general fact, whenever you have, I mean, you may be more familiar with it in the following context. Like, if you have a topological space and you have a subspace, then the inclusion of the one topological space in the other will give you a map backwards on cohomology, and hence an action of the cohomology of the bigger thing on the cohomology of the smaller thing. Now, when you were dealing with intersection homology here, it's a bit more complicated because this thing is not a ring. So, and there's not a restriction map. Be careful about that thing. But anyway, yeah, there's not a restriction map like this. But nonetheless, there is always an action of the cohomology of the big guy on the intersection homology of any subvariety. So there is an action of this guy here. In particular, I have this first Turing class here. Particular, I can consider the action of this first Turing class on the intersection homology. And it turns out this is exactly the extra piece of information we need, just the action of this one particular element in the homology of the full affine Grassmannian. So let me state a theorem which basically is due independently to Ginzburg and Vassarow, although perhaps was known before them to other experts. So under the isomorphism that we've been considering between the intersection homology of Grillander bar and V lambda, the action of the first Turing class of this line bundle corresponds to pretty much the sum of those EIs. So the left-hand side, I'm saying I have an action of this one particular operator. The right-hand side, I have an action of all of G-check, but I'm only going to focus on one element in G-check, which is the sum of the EIs. Well, not quite the sum of the EIs, but some linear combination of the EIs. And So what the DIs are depends on this line bundle L, but when in the case when G is simple and simply laced and you pick the minimum line bundle, all the DIs are 1. So you can choose the right normalization in the simple, simply laced case to get, so it really is just the sum of the EIs. So you should think that the action of this first Turing class of this very ample line bundle is this principal nilpotence element of your Lie algebra. So in SLN, it would just be the guy with all 1s just above the diagonal. Okay. That's a kind of useful general statement. Now we want to get something more specific for the action of these EIs on our preferred basis here, namely our basis of MV cycles. So that Z contained inside your lambda intersect S mu are V and MV cycle. So let me write bracket Z for the class inside the intersection homology of the thing. So the corresponding basis element inside this intersection homology. And then choose a hyperplane section H of my projective space. So just a hyperplane inside my projective space such that H intersect S mu bar is equal to the union over nu smaller than mu of S nu. And this is actually, I mean, you might, it's not maybe, it's not very hard, actually very hard to prove that, that there is such a hyperplane section. This was done by Mirkovich and Maloney. In fact, they use the existence of such a hyperplane section. They use this to show that each of these S mu plus alpha i's, it was, oops, this thing should be bigger than, sorry, I have my annotation. Let me reverse this inequality. Smaller than this. So this means, i.e., nu minus mu is a linear combination, is a positive combination of positive roots. So they use this to show that each of these S mu plus alpha i's is a divisor in S mu. So we're trying to understand the action of EI on this basis element in our intersection homology. So after we identify it with V lambda. So the first step is to sort of, we're motivated by this, we have this hyperplane section H. And now, what are we going to do? We're going to take H and intersect it with our Z, our MV cycle. And take H intersect with Z. So this will now, I should mention, from now on, everything I'm talking about will be joined with Pierre Beaumont. So, and this results have not appeared yet. They will appear hopefully in the next couple of months. Okay. So the theorem is that H intersect Z is non-reduced. So it's some kind of scheme which is not a variety, not necessarily a variety, but it's, anyway, so it's some non-reduced union of smaller MV cycles.
And for each I, we get the action of our Chevalier generator, or rather, di times our Chevalier generator. But this di is a constant which doesn't depend on anything else in the game, so it's good enough just to have. I mean, only depends on this line bundle. So the action of this di ei on our z is given as follows: is the sum over y's, which are irreducible components of gr lambda intersect s mu plus alpha I. So this is not at all surprising, right? Because we know that this EI guy will take us from the mu weight space to the mu plus alpha I weight space, and the mu plus alpha I weight space is a basis given by the irreducible components of this thing. So the theorem of Mirkovich and Milonen that started it. So there's some. It's not surprising that you can write it like this, but the point is that we know this coefficient, so this coefficient is, let me call it L sub y, h intersect z, where, so where these coefficients are some positive or non-negative integers, non-negative integer is the multiplicity of our scheme h intersect z along y. So these different y's are going to be the irreducible components. I mean, some of them anyway will be the irreducible components of h intersect z. If y is not contained in h intersect z, then that number is 0. And if it is, then it's the multiplicity of the scheme along y. Okay. So let me try to show you. Well, as a quick corollary of this, this implies that all y which occur on the right hand side are contained in h intersect z. So this implies that the polytope of the y is contained inside the polytope of z, and actually it also should be contained inside the polytope of this s mu plus alpha y. So this allows you to kind of, in some simple situations, to really see exactly what possible terms can appear. So let me do an example. So it's sort of like a non-specific example or something, just to show you the general kind of situation. So again, G is SL3, and let me pick some MV polytope. I'm not going to specify exactly what the representation is, but it's there's some mu and some lambda and some mu in the game. So this is our mu as usual. This is our lambda. Don't want to come like this. Okay, good. So I take this the z, and then I take h intersect z. And anyway, what I know about the h intersect z is that it's contained inside z, and it's contained inside. Any y which occurs in this thing, say in particular for I, is contained inside z, and it's also contained inside this. So any y which occurs, its MV polytope will have to be contained inside the intersection of the MV polytope for z and the MV polytope for s mu plus alpha I. And there's precisely two, so maybe not immediately obvious if you haven't played with MV polytopes, but there's precisely two MV polytopes which are contained inside this region here with lowest vertex here. So one MV polytope is the one that you get from the crystal structure. That's the blue guy. So that's the one from the crystal structure. So the blue guy is the EI tilde P. And then there's another guy, which looks like this. And you can tell that this was the one you got from the crystal structure, because for this one, all these vertices were unchanged, and for the pink guy, this vertex and this vertex changed. Okay. So there's two y one, and so in this sum there'll be two terms, and in this case of SL3, it's possible to explicitly compute what those coefficients are in general. I mean, for every MV polytope, there'll always be either two guys or one guy that show up, and it's possible to explicitly compute those coefficients. But in the general case, I don't know neither how many possible terms appear, nor what the coefficients will be. So I know that they have this geometric meaning now, the coefficients, but I just don't know what, and that they're positive, I just don't know what they are. Okay, let me explain, to conclude, I'll just explain how this interacts with the crystal structure that I presented earlier. Any questions about, maybe I should have paused your questions a while ago. Any questions about it, this picture? Sorry? So, well, I just think that they're one. If G is simple and simply laced, they're one. And Jonah?
Yeah, is this related to
crystal maybe I'm about to answer that question.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Yeah. So, Jonah. So this you could take what I'm about to say now is kind of related. So I'm going to introduce the notion of perfect basis. So let V be a representation. So this notion is due to Ehrenstein, Feierstein. So let V be a representation of G check. And now we define an epsilon I function on V, a map from V to the non-negative integers by V is sent to the max value of n such that EI, so EI again is the Chevalier generator of the algebra, EIN of V is not zero. Okay, so the biggest power of V you can hit it with not get zero. Then a basis B for V is called perfect if the following two things are hold. So one, each B in B is a weight vector. That's not very surprising. Compatible with this. It's an eigenvector for the action of the torus. And second property is you would like, in some sense, the action of the EI to act in some combinatorial fashion. Now, this is somehow impossible to achieve in general. So one way to kind of achieve it, in some sense, is to use the notion of crystal basis due to Kashiwara, which involves the quantum group. But I want, this notion of perfect basis is some kind of replacement of the notion of crystal basis when I'm not dealing with the representation of quantum group, just the representation of Lie algebra. Or you could be dealing with the representation of quantum group, but you're not dealing with any property of q equals zero. Okay. So let me say the second thing. For each B in B and I in I, there exists another basis vector, which denoted epsilon I tilde of B, another basis vector, such that the action of EI on B, so this is just some formal symbol now, yeah? I mean, this is not an operator acting my representation, this is just a formal symbol. So there exists some guy, another basis vector, EI tilde of B, such that the regular EI of B gives you EI tilde of B times a coefficient, which is predictable, namely it's epsilon I of B, so this non-negative integer, plus some x, so there's something else, where epsilon I of the EI tilde of B is sort of exactly one less than the epsilon I of B, you kind of expect that, you know, if you apply EI once, you'll get something that you can apply EI, well, one less time. And the other guys, X, have a strictly smaller epsilon I. Actually, oops, sorry. Strictly smaller than this. Having written this, do I want... Maybe I should write something slightly stronger. Sorry. Maybe write something slightly stronger. I don't know whether it's... I'm not sure which one I want. But anyway, let's write something slightly stronger. Let's say that this is some sum over B prime in B. Let's say C B prime. And let me say for the stronger thing, C B prime is equal to, not equal to 0, implies that it's epsilon I is strictly smaller. Epsilon I prime is strictly smaller than this one. Sorry. I think I got what I wanted. Okay, so there is a leading... The basic point you should take from this is that in the sense of this epsilon I function, there is a leading term. There's a kind of leading term in the expansion of this thing in the basis. So you apply EI, you expand in the basis, and this guy is the leading term. So plus, I'm defining, still defining the notion of perfect basis, so it has this property plus corresponding property for FI. So the reason why this is a nice notion is the following. So given a perfect basis, you can define a crystal structure on the set B. So much like if you have a crystal basis in the sense of Kashiwara, you can define a crystal structure on the underlying set of the crystal basis. And here, how do the crystal operators act? Well, I mean, it acts by this guy. The I crystal operator takes you from B to epsilon I tilde of B. So, and much like as in crystal bases, there's kind of lots of these perfect bases, perhaps, but every one gives rise to the same crystal. So the theorem is that if B prime are two perfect bases for a V, then B is isomorphic to B prime as crystals. So the crystal doesn't depend on the choice of perfect bases. This is the theorem of Bernstein and Kashan. So I always think that this notion of perfect basis deserves to be kind of better known, because it's sort of much more elementary than the notion of crystal basis, and still produces you crystals, and still produces you a unique crystal for each representation. But in any case, so as a corollary now to state the final thing, so the point is, when you do this intersection, like in this example, you get, as I said, it turns out in this example there were two terms, and one term was the crystal operator, and one term is this guy here, and this guy actually has one smaller epsilon I, because epsilon I is measuring the length of this piece of the polytope, it turns out. So this piece of the polytope has two smaller than this guy, so it does satisfy a constraint, and that's a general term. So this is a corollary of the previous theorem. So, well, I'll just say it in the theorem to avoid confusion. So this is, but it essentially follows. It follows from that theorem is that the V basis is a perfect basis. So in general, it's sort of perfect basis. Kind of is slightly. It's a very simple definition. It's very hard to prove that there exists. There's no way to prove sort of abstractly that there exists a perfect basis of a representation. So every proof of that there is a perfect basis is by kind of construction and kind of complicated construction. And but it's sort of believed that probably there's lots of perfect bases. So, but anyway, as a result of this geometric theorem over there, we're able to prove that this MB basis is a perfect basis, which is kind of something that people expected, but there was no existing proof. So just to conclude, as I said, the kind of challenge that I would like to sort of throw out there is to try to deduce more information about these intersections of these MB cycles with the hyperplane sections, and which MB cycles can appear, and what are their multiplicities in those intersections. Yeah, you're right. That's one way of doing it. It's actually not quite the FI. You get the whole sum by the hard left shifts. So that's one way of doing it. Yeah. I don't know of any kind of more explicit way of doing it. Yeah. That's sort of a minor point, which is that in this paper of Vassar, he does give the EI individually, but it's by some very complicated method that's not very helpful. At least not that helpful. At least we never found it that helpful. Somehow more helpful was to just use the sum and then project, sort of like we did here. So you notice that the right-hand side is not all of kind of H intersect Z, because, you know, there'll be sort of pieces of the H intersect Z which correspond to the other alpha I, but the part of EI is just given by the right-hand side. To get kind of each, in Vassarow's paper, to get each sort of EI individually, he does some slightly complicated thing involving going to the affine Grassmannian of the levy corresponding to the I, and this was sort of We don't know any way to sort of geometrically see that. Yeah, but this sort of was, I don't think, maybe in the end it's equivalent to this, but it was sort of easier just to do the whole thing and then project. So the observation, the kind of trivial observation, is that if you have an action of the sum of the EIs and you know the weight space decomposition, well, that's enough to get you each EI individually, because you just apply the sum of the EIs and then project to the plus alpha I weight space. With a basis? No idea. I mean, with a Gelfand-Zeeland basis, definitely not the same. On a combinatorial level, it's pretty easy to sort of write down a bijection between Gelfand-Zeeland patterns and these MB polytopes. But on the basis level, not that much is known. There's some results in Taipei relating the MB basis to some things called semi-canonical basis, which arose in the work of Ginsburg and Nakajima. So there's some results relating that, but probably it doesn't coincide with Ginsburg. I mean, with the Gelfand-Zeeland. So for highest weight modules for affine algebras, then one would need some kind of affine analog of the affine Grassmannian. I mean, affine Grassmannian for the one way to do it would be to have an affine analog of the affine Grassmannian. So this has been studied a lot in recent years, especially by Finkelberg and Bauerman and Finkelberg. But I don't know any way to get the kind of combinatorics out of that. And there's some other approaches to just trying to get the combinatorics directly, and I guess this is something I've been working on, especially this week with Peter Tingley. So stay tuned.